lot of times. And so I imagine our brain is like a universe. And our universe brain is populated with stars and planets and comets and all kinds of things. And they're all different experiences, different relationships, different skills that we have, different experiences. And if you have a wide universe brain, because you have a wide range of relationships or breadth of experience, and you try new things, then when you have that rocket ship that takes off when your default mode network is daydreaming, your rocket ship takes off and wanders around your universe trying to collect and assimilate different experiences to create an insight. So if you have a massive universe brain with lots of different experiences, you'll have a much more unique and individual insight. But I say if you have a small universe brain because you drink the same latte every day, you hang out with the same people from the same culture, you're not going to have a very good insight. It's going to be pretty boring. So that's novelty, is to create those stars and comets and planets in your brain so that you can collect new experiences.
And that's really what intercultural creativity is about. It's that intersection between intercultural experiences, not just culture, meaning ethnic culture, but different lived experiences on all different demographics, psychographics, and lived experiences, and how it affects creative thinking and how cognitively they're sitting on the same set of skills that you can enhance one and enhance the other. And it was you who shared that, because I was thinking about, someone said something about the universe and stars, and I have my diamond is the logo of my company. Yes. And shine bright like a diamond. And I also say twinkle, twinkle, little star, like diamonds in the sky. So that yes. made my connection. Welcome to the Create and Grow podcast. This is Janine Ledford, your host and the creator of the groundbreaking concept of intercultural creativity, which is the intersection of creative thinking and cultural competence. So if you're looking for new, exciting ways to build a positive culture of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging that sparks creativity, this is your place. We have exciting guests in all types of fields who highlight how creative thinking best thrives in a culture of diverse collaboration. At the Create and Grow podcast, you'll discover how inclusion drives innovation. Enjoy the show. Welcome to the Create and Grow podcast, formerly Create and Grow Rich. I am your host, Janine Ledford, and I am so excited to be with you today, bringing the top minds in creativity to the forefront. I have with me Dr. Caroline Brookfield out of Canada. She is an unlikely creativity advocate. As a veterinarian, she prioritizes data and research. My kind of person. Her inner creative would not be ignored. And now, as a speaker and soon to be best-selling author, because I know it's going to do that, her mission is to democratize everyday creativity, especially for left-brainers, to help them find what is missing. No arts and crafts required. One other reason that I'm so excited to bring her to the show is she was probably one of the first huge advocates of I Am Creative, a book that my son wrote, and she's going to be talking about her book. But she ordered numerous copies for her family because I love when people get this, she saw the intuitiveness that it's for kids, but it's also for adults. And she'll talk more about that as we dive in. Welcome to the Create and Grow podcast, Dr. Caroline.
Oh, thank you so much, Jean. Just call me Caroline. It's still, after 25 years, feels weird when people call me doctor.
I had the thing where I say, if someone went through that much schooling to get their doctorate, I'm going to call you a doctor. I call everyone doctor. And I talk like, Dr. Caroline, welcome to the show. And it's just a way for me to acknowledge the hard work. I'm actually thinking about getting my doctorate as well. Someone told me, it's like, you have a unique idea. You did the research. You even wrote a book about it. Like, what's stopping you from getting your doctorate? I'm like, yeah. I have a 3-year-old at home. But welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
I am just excited to jump in and to get your perspective, your expertise, your research, and your integration of your interesting background. Could you give a background about who you are and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. Thank you, Janine. And yeah, I just want to say I loved your book with your son, and it is an incredible book for anybody. I think it should be on every waiting room table because it's easy to read and fun and very informative. Well done to you and your son. So for me, I guess my elevator kind of condensation of my life is, as a child, I'd always loved animals. And growing up in the kind of the 80s, it was always like, what flavor of professional are you going to be successful? And because of my love of animals, it was kind of predestined that I would be a veterinarian. And I did really like the science and biology, and I was excited about that path. When I hit high school, I developed this love and passion for performance. So drama, improv, and I really loved photography. But ironically, even though becoming a veterinarian is a very challenging career, it seemed easier because I had no idea how I would become a cinematographer or like an actor. I was like, I don't want to live in a basement all my life. So I went on to become a veterinarian and did that. I've been doing that since 1997. But I always kind of felt like something was missing. And I don't know, Janine, if you've ever had this or you've met people who felt like it's just not, there's something else. And so I kind of hopped around to different jobs within vet med and never really found it. And it wasn't until I started taking acting classes again and doing stand-up comedy and writing that I realized that it was this creativity that I was kind of missing, that I had set aside in this need to focus on the science. And I felt like I really integrated all parts of myself when I reconnected with that.
There's so much there. You know, I'm going to dive in because this is both of our work, right? Both of our research of looking at the integration of them both. And when we say, just for my audience, they know how I define creativity, that it's not only the arts are a big part of it and can help in non-arts areas, which we are about to discuss, but it's really, for me and our company, we say it's the process of problem finding and problem solving. Mm-hmm. Even if you're solving with the arts, sometimes, you know, a musical idea and how do I solve the issue of making this communicative bridge, basically, right? With your art, with your music, or what have you. So the process of problem finding and problem solving with relevance, value, and novelty, but it's course with art. So with that, how did you feel and what progress or just what evolution did you have as you were still doing your veterinarian work, but really diving into the artistic aspect of your personality and your essence?
Yeah, it was interesting because I think one of the first things was, you know, I'd been taking the acting classes and that was felt more like a hobby. And then I had a business where I was helping vets find part-time staff. And then I closed that for many reasons. And then I opened a jewelry business. And I discovered it took some business coaching and a bit of reflection to realize that I just love the creation part of the business. So once I created the business, I was kind of not as interested in it, which is a whole nother story. But it was this idea of loving taking something that's nothing and turning it into something in the world. And I just realized that I loved that process. And then combined with that, I had a job where I was technical services for a pet food company. And so a large part of my job was giving presentations and taking really complicated technical information and making it understandable. And I just loved being on stage. And through this whole messy process, I realized most people hate public speaking and I love being on stage, whether it's performing or stand-up or speaking. And I thought there's something here, but it's almost like people say they have a goal, like a specific goal. I struggled with that because I didn't have a specific goal. I knew that there was all these puzzle pieces on the table, like my, you know, love of science and data and my love of performance and creativity. And I just couldn't put them all together. And through a whole 2 or 3 year messy process, I finally realized I wanted to be a public speaker. And what would I speak about? Well, it's about this idea of tapping into your creativity, even when you're not like a creative, because I hesitated to talk to my coworkers about the creative things that I was doing because I thought they would think it was weird. And like, why would you have a jewelry business when you're a vet? Like, doesn't make any sense. And one of the things I identified early on is this barrier to creativity is this fear of judgment from other people. And that's really what I've tried to combine is this idea that just because you're in a serious or a scientific role doesn't mean that you can't engage your creativity and improve on that same role. It doesn't mean you have to go out and paint and wear hemp and grow your hair long, whatever, right? But because of my background with being a veterinarian and doing research, I really dove into the research around creativity and specifically everyday creativity, as opposed to the big C creativity that a lot of people talk about.
So a lot of people may not know what that means. Could you quickly give a background of the big C, little C, and then we're going to talk about the fear of judgment and cultural expectations that dampen people's ability to shine every day creatively.
Yes, definitely. When I dove into the creativity research, what I found early on was there wasn't even a consistent definition of what creativity is. So some people say creativity has to be something unique in a domain that's judged by your peers as novel and useful. And then there's the work of Ruth Richards, and that would be considered, I think, big C creativity, like the iPhone or Da Vinci's work would all be large, like capital C or big C creativity. And I'm a real fan of Ruth Richards' work and this everyday creativity, which would be more like little C creativity or small C. And that's things like building a pivot table or choosing your outfit or throwing a dash of paprika in your tacos for something different. Like those are all things that I consider everyday creativity.
I love it. I love it. And it's so accessible to people because you're like, wait, I can close my eyes and pick a spice out and throw it in my tacos and see what, let's see what happens. And I love the guests that I've had on the show because I've had a chef who's been on cooking shows on the show. I've had a neuroscience. I've had people in different fields. And my job as I interview you is to show people where the 16 diamond tools of creative thinking or the 7 gems of intercultural creativity are coming up in what you're saying. And I love that people get to talk about or think about or hear about the little C and big C and say that they can start somewhere. So that is awesome. Let's go into what you said before about the fear of judgment, the line of why are you opening a jewelry shop? You're a veterinarian. Like one thing excludes you from the other. Talk about that. Talk about the research and talk about some things that people can do to take baby steps to amend those erroneous beliefs.
Yeah, I see it so often. And I think for people, especially who have been used to being competent in their career, who have been doing what they've been doing for a while, they get this kind of sense of competence and we lose our ability to fail and bounce back and recover because we're used to doing well. I call it an outdated operating system when we talk about this fear of judgment, because, you know, when we were living in small groups, if we were excluded from our group, we would die, like starvation or predation or frozen to death. Up here, it's minus 25 Celsius, so we definitely freeze to death up here. It's crazy.
She's in Canada, by the way, in case you, she's not where I am, in Phoenix, Arizona.
Oh, no. Although the northern U.S. states are probably feeling this cold right now, too. So we'd freeze to death if we got excluded from our group. And I feel like this is an evolutionary survival adaptation that's no longer serving us. Our pace of change in our culture and our world has rapidly outpaced our ability as humans to adapt to it. So we have these outdated operating systems, and one of which is fit in, be part of the group, don't stand out, because you needed to do that in a small group where you were surviving and, you know, dial up internet in the cave kind of thing.
Good times, good times. I love that. Oh, congratulations. Or you've got mail, right? Awesome. And a lot of my work, and I'm not sure, I think you've done some work. Well, of course you have if you're a veterinarian, but I'm really getting used to the neuroscience. I've been in neuroscience for about 20 years. When I say been in, I mean like literally in the fMRI machines, helping my professors get data. Now I'm on the other side of the machines helping us say, what does this data mean and how can we be better educators in the classroom and leaders in the boardroom? What does that look like? And so when you say the fear of being excluded, the fear of standing up, even the fear of offering an idea that's against the status quo, right? What does that look like? What's going on in our brains and how can people take some steps to mitigate that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what helps me is having ADHD, because everybody has that gift. It's not always a gift, but in this case, the impulsivity, and I call myself a monitor with no hard drive at times, because, and that's an advantage, because you kind of forget what, you know, what that rejection has felt like, and they've linked ADHD to creativity. But I think the key for anything, Janine, in life is to practice. When you see someone in the boardroom that's speaking some idea that seems a little bit unusual, or that everyone's like, I can't believe they said that. That idea sounds like it's off the wall. It's because that person has practiced stepping into that uncertainty and sharing their thoughts, and realize that for the most part, they're not going to die if they share their opinion. Yes, people might not think it's a good idea, but overall, you start remembering the times that you took that risk and ignored that fear of judgment, and it paid off. It's not going to be every time. But just like anything, I don't know what you think, Janine, but I feel like it's a muscle you need to practice, and creativity is a perfect way to build that muscle.
I love it. I told you that I just got finished listening to a podcast with Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett, who is a neuroscientist. And she talks about how the brain and the metabolic, basically the budget brain, right? There's a certain amount of energy we have a day. And the brain has to kind of say, okay, well, who gets this? Who gets that? Mm-hmm. And if the brain is depleted, it's going to hold back in some areas. Mm-hmm. And she talked about how being creative is very expensive, basically, for the brain. It's not like you're just doing rote memorization, putting a cog into a machine. You're actually, what you love to doing, bringing the imagination into an actual manifestation. And that is very expensive, that the brain really has to work. And so for people to practice, the creativity is a muscle. I love that. Because just like we want our muscles to get strong, we want our brain and our creativity to get strong. So we have to practice. Have you ever felt the fatigue that can almost inhibit this from happening? And what are some of the things that you do to help you get back into that practice of mm-hmm. being creative?
Yeah, definitely. That's a good insight. And it's funny because while it is very cognitively demanding and probably expensive, I think was the word you used, I think what one of the biggest problems is people don't give their brain the space to do that work. So I have an acronym for 5 habits for people to engage their creativity. And the first one is daydream, right? Speaking of fMRI, and that's how we engage our default mode network, which is the network that helps to make all those different connections and helps to create an insight or a problem that you're trying to solve. And it's engaged when we're kind of doing nothing. I say when we're doing nothing, sometimes we're doing everything. And while it might be expensive from like a metabolic standpoint and demanding, it's something that people really struggle to do because it feels like nothing. So even though it's probably metabolically demanding, it doesn't feel like you're doing anything. It doesn't feel like you're productive or you're getting anything done. And so one of the things that I really try to do is make sure I give myself that time and space and rest to make sure I get enough sleep. And try not to pick up this thing when I'm waiting in line or when I'm sitting eating my breakfast. I try just to look out the window and watch the birds freezing in the snow. So that daydreaming is one of the big things I would say for people to use to engage that habit.
And could you actually, let's go into it. And I say about the cell phone, I'm like, leave your cell phone out of the bathroom, people. Just leave it out of the bathroom and just daydream while you're there. That's one step you can take today. Is leave it out of the bathroom and daydream. So could you talk about why we should not forget to dance?
Yes. I like things to be explained to me very simply, even though I love to read the research. I just love things that are just kind of easy to implement as opposed to these like 12 steps you have to spend like 12 hours every day. So I've distilled what I think are 5 really important habits for people who think they're not really creative, but they know they should be or they want to be, and they don't really know where to start. So the first one, and it spells the word dance. So the first one being daydream. So it's taking the time to just allow your brain to simmer on those problems. And briefly, I love the research around how to daydream effectively for creativity, because there's ways that you can daydream that are more effective. Thinking about some problem you're trying to solve. The other one is thinking about something fantastical. Like, what would your life be like if you were Lady Gaga or something? Like, those are 2 ways to daydream that are the most productive for creativity, according to some research. So that's daydream. Sorry, I get excited about the research. I tangent.
We are like-minded minds in that regard. So keep the research coming, please.
Great. Yeah. So yes, daydream is the first one. A is for ambiguity. And I love the research by Karen Fuster out of Australia, where she has done a lot of research on ambiguity in the workplace and a dimension called tolerance of ambiguity. Mm-hmm. And tolerance of ambiguity is highly correlated with both creativity and resilience. So the idea is, if you are able to be more tolerant in ambiguity, where you don't know the answer and you don't get shoved into our reaction to uncertainty, which is status quo solutions, then you can be more creative if you can sit in that space, being in the moment, as opposed to worrying about what's going to happen. So working on
No, I was going to say, before you go on to the next one, in my book that I'm going to send you, I actually talk about how they mention even Shakespeare, that one reason why he was able to come up with some amazing stories, because he had, they called it something else. It wasn't a really scientific word of like just comfort with the negative or something, but he was able just to sit with the unknown and not feel the need to come to a conclusion right away. Yes. Some people kind of feel that we need to resolve it, right? Almost like that B tone. I don't know if you have a music background, but that T, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, T.
Oh,
and you're like, okay, come on, give me no, right? No. Like I have to resolve. But people were okay with people like him in that highly creative aspect, what they were able just to sit in that ambiguity and be okay with it.
Yeah, I think, and part of that in from Karen's research talks about how part of it is related to your genetics and some of it's related to your personality, but they are influenceable. Is that a word? Like I am highly tolerant to ambiguity. And so I know that about myself and there are people who aren't, but there are things that you can do to increase that confidence in uncertainty. One of the things that I find interesting is a dimension highly studied in physicians. There's one study in veterinarians. But what they found is physicians who have a higher tolerance of ambiguity order less tests. Like they don't order every single test on the block to be absolutely certain of their diagnosis, which can lead to overdiagnosis, which is not necessarily a good thing. They have better mental health if they have a higher tolerance of ambiguity. So there's a lot of things about it that are helpful for our whole lives, not just for creativity.
Awesome. And so that's the D, A. So you're on N.
N. N is for novelty. And so I like to think in pictures a lot of times. And so I imagine our brain is like a universe. And our universe brain is populated with stars and planets and comets and all kinds of things. And they're all different experiences, different relationships, different skills that we have, different experiences. And if you have a wide universe brain, because you have a wide range of relationships or breadth of experience and you try new things, then when you have that rocket ship that takes off when your default mode network is daydreaming, your rocket ship takes off and wanders around your universe trying to collect and assimilate different experiences to create an insight. So if you have a massive universe brain with lots of different experiences, you'll have a much more unique and individual insight. But I say if you have a small universe brain because you drink the same latte every day, you hang out with the same people from the same culture, you're not going to have a very good insight. It's going to be pretty boring. So that's novelty, is to create those stars and comets and planets in your brain so that you can collect new experiences.
And that's really what intercultural creativity is about. It's that intersection between intercultural experiences, not just culture, meaning ethnic culture, but different lived experiences on all different demographics, psychographics, and lived experiences, and how it affects creative thinking and how cognitively they're sitting on the same set of skills that you can enhance one and enhance the other. And it was you who shared that, because I was thinking about, someone said something about the universe and stars, and I have my diamond is the logo of my company. Yes. And shine bright like a diamond. And I also say twinkle twinkle little star, like diamonds in the sky. So that made my connection. It's great to know where that came from, because I can give you credit, because I know it wasn't my metaphor. I was like, no, I heard this somewhere, and you were on someone else's podcast. So thank you again for sharing this on my podcast, and I will give you credit if I share it in the future.
I love your diamond, so I might start using that, and I'll credit you for that, like diamonds. And I can like sing, but people don't want me to sing because I cannot sing.
We all can sing. It's just a level of competency that changes, is what I say. But with that, so the power of connecting the diamonds and connecting the dots and the stars. And I also want to just highlight the experiential learning. And like, I had a friend in town that I met from an event years ago. She's like, yeah, I'm going to be in Arizona. I have a friend who is cattle roping and he's practicing. And if you want to come out and watch us rope cattle, I'm like, I've never done that before. Sure. So I grab my 3-year-old son and we sit there, and you'll see the video. I'll tag you when I post it. And I'm like, we're sitting here watching these people rope cattle in like on a Tuesday at 3, you know? And I love that. And that's why I wanted my son to be there, because now he has that mind map. He has that star in his universe that before we would have never experienced that at all.
And what I love about it is that when you go to that experience with your son, with the cattle roping, it might not be tomorrow, it might not be next week, but in 5 years, when you're trying to do something together, whether it's doing some project in the backyard or something with a leadership team, something from that cattle roping might give you that insight, but you won't even necessarily know it's the cattle roping that's what popped. It's just one of those things those ingredients. I had a business coach, her name's Kelsey Ramsen. She is amazing. And she wrote a book. And in there, she uses the analogy of making, if you want to make vanilla cake, then stock your pantry with vanilla cake ingredients. But if you want to make a different cake, you need new ingredients. So like your cattle rope example is like a new star or a new ingredient in your pantry. And you might not even remember it's from the cattle roping when you throw it in your tacos, right? And that's a great example.
Oh, that's awesome. And it's also like the functional aspects. It's like, yeah, you don't may not think it's coming from the cattle roping, but maybe it's the function of the bull running with the horse. And so that reminds you about something else. And so when your brain is creatively separating the parts and then putting them back together, you don't know which part from that. Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for bringing that up. I never really thought of that.
Or and even lastly, something like the way they wrap the rope around their hand, right? Mm-hmm. Like when you're going to do something, go fishing someday, you might be like, oh, remember that cattle roper? Like it was weird the way he did something through his fingers or whatever. I should try that. I don't know, maybe not fishing, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, you never know what. Oh, and then the last thing I wanted to say, one thing I started doing with him, with his experiences, is I try to be in the moment, I know, and I try not to have my phone out. But I'll take like a minute of video and then I'll put it on his iPad. We do have limited screen time and he had no screen time before the age of two, but I'll put it on his iPad so he can relive the experience and it can get deeper into his subconscious. Mm-hmm. Say, remember when that happened? And he'll watch it a few times and then he'll go on and do something else. And then he'll watch it again 2 weeks later. Yeah. And yeah, I just wanted to share that.
Well, you're doing better than me. I have a 13 and a 15-year-old, and basically they've been playing games nonstop. Like school's been extended. The break has been extended a week. It's been minus 25 to 30 here the whole break. So don't feel bad. My kids have been basically plugged into games like a lot.
No worries. So D is for daydream. A is for ambiguity. N is for novelty. And C is for
the foundation of what I think foundational catalyst for creativity is curiosity. So without curiosity, we don't wonder how things could be different. So curiosity is one of the foundational habits, I think, for developing creativity.
Awesome. I think that I say if creativity is a driver of innovation, curiosity is a driver of creativity. So you and I are certainly in alignment with that. And the fact that it's not something that I had to teach Sean. Like he came here with it. And I don't know if you've seen the research that they've tested infants and their curiosity level, and it's inbred. And so the work that you and I are doing is to how do we get these adults back to their childlike, not childish, childlike levels of curiosity. What are some things that you can give people to employ today?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And before I answer your question, one of the things that's kind of disturbed me, and I don't know who did the, Emma was like, who did the research and what's their stats and stuff? But the research has said that Gen Z is Canada, Gen Z is US. Gen Z are apparently the least curious generation, which is kind of disturbing if that's true. But I think staying curious is a lot about mindfulness. And so what I find fascinating is that the research says that mindfulness, which is the focused meditation style mindfulness, is actually negatively correlated with creativity, because staying in the moment is like what's happening now, whereas creativity is like in the future. But, and this is something my friend Karen, who did the work on tolerance of ambiguity, talked about, is that it gives the space to be curious and creative because you're not reacting. You're not like, this is happening, I'm going to react. It's like, I'm staying in the moment and I'm giving myself that space to be open to possibility. So I think that to answer your question about what can help with curiosity, it's being mindful, like finding something in your life and be like who, like glasses, how did they figure out, like how do they make glass? And then when do they stick it up to their eyeballs and think like, I can see better, you know, like there's so much to be curious about if you employ a more childlike thinking. Like I did a video series of dares recently, and one of them was pretend you're a 2-year-old. What would a 2-year-old do in your house, on your walk to work or in your office, and try to engage that childlike enthusiasm? And don't think that you know everything all the time. The curiosity is something that we have to engage deliberately. And I think, again, it comes back to these outdated operating systems. If we stayed as clueless as a kindergartner, sure, we'd be creative, but we probably would still be living in those caves with dial-up internet, right? I mean, we make shortcuts and heuristics about our world so that we don't have to use all that time and energy to figure out how to survive. And the byproduct of that is that we have all these assumptions about the world. It's hard to kind of push those away and see things without the layers of experience that we have. So I think it's a skill to be mindful and also to take the time and to be open to thinking about things differently.
And that's how I connected to intercultural creativity is how can we be curious about our environment and the creative aspect, but also how can we be curious about the people in our lives and people not in our lives, but be curious in a respectful way where we're not entering into like microaggressions or anything like that. But it supports both. And something that, do you know who, I think they wrote the 13 thinking tools of highly creative people, Dr. Robert Root Bernstein and his wife. Yes, you might enjoy it. It is a thick book, so it's not like an easy read.
Yeah.
It's an academic read and really inspired my 16 diamond tools of creative thinking. Yeah. But he talked about, he and his wife talked about the importance of recognizing first versus observation. And observation is one of my seven gems. Mm-hmm. And when we see things and we recognize it, we just say, oh, okay, that's a stapler, just keep on going.
Yes.
But to observe, like when a two-year-old observes a stapler, they're like, well, what is this? And what does it, like when I watch my son look at a stapler, something that I wouldn't even give a second look to, it suddenly puts me back into that observation mindset.
Yeah. And it's like, it's contagious, right? When other people do that. And one of the studies that I find fascinating, which you've probably heard about, is where they took two groups of kindergartners. Again, they always like to study kindergartners. I guess they don't have a ethical review as strongly, I don't know, but they took two groups of kindergartners and they gave each group the same toy. But in one group, the teacher said, look at this toy, this is what it does. And then the other group, they just said, here is this toy. And the kids in the room where they were directed to the toy, they lost interest faster and they didn't find some of the features of the toy. Whereas the group that were inspired to explore the toy stayed with it longer and they found all kinds of neat features. So I think it's also about how we position things with other people. And that made me think when you mentioned your son with the stapler, like it would be easy to say, here, this is what it does, put the paper in there and do this. But if you give the stapler and say, I wonder what you'd use this for, what kind of ideas might he give you? It would probably be completely different than what the intended use is of the item, right?
I love it. And that's when I talk about functional agility, the MacGyver mind. Like, how do you make a contraption out of a piece of bubblegum wrapper and a toothpick, you know? Yeah. And it's amazing. Yeah. And so for us to get back to there, and there's a lot of research about functional agility in the workplace. We see it in children. We know it's there. That's whole the concept of playing with a box for 2 hours, right?
Yes.
But how do we bring functional agility in the workforce? And I love that. All right. So dance, D-A-N-C. Yes.
And then E, which I think is the low-hanging fruit for anybody who's looking for something, anything they can do to be more creative. And it's a little awkward because it's two words, but it's editing later. And I love the work of Dr. George Land, where he talks about separating our divergent, anything is possible thinking from our convergent, what is the right answer thinking. And he talks about them being like the gas and the brake, right? So the gas is the divergent thinking, the brake is the convergent thinking to select an idea. And as we do that in every stage of creative problem solving and design thinking. But one extra layer I've added to that, because I had a Camaro as a family vehicle when I was a teenager. I don't know. I was embarrassed to drive it. I was weird. I was a teenager.
Awesome.
But do you know what? I think in the US they call it something different. Do you know what a brake stand is, Janine?
No.
Okay. Do you know what a burnout is?
Like when the car goes fast really quickly and the tires...
Well, kind of. Okay. So, okay, imagine you press the gas and the brake, like floored them at the same time. What do you think would happen?
I don't know. It probably wouldn't go, but it would. Well, the tires wouldn't rotate. Right.
So you get a brake stand is what I called it. And maybe it's a Canadian term. So the
I know tires what a headstand.
Spin, right? Uh-huh. Yeah, and you see all the smoke, right? Mm-hmm, and then it's like screaming rubber. But then the car's not going anywhere. If you look out the window, there's a lot of stuff going on, but you're not going anywhere. So the biggest barrier I see to especially people in like corporate or less traditionally creative environments doing is to do both of those at the same time, whether they do that themselves to themselves and judge their ideas as they're creating them, or whether they do it in a meeting and say, well, that'll never work. We tried that last time, you know, and this idea of like separating your divergent from convergent thinking, I think is the number one thing people could do to get better ideas, more unique solutions, and have better innovation, really.
And really to have that divergent thinking time and maybe even go home and sleep on it and let your subconscious play around with some of those ideas before you converge. Wow, I love it. I love it all. And I heard someone speak today about, you know, what you mentioned, the almost the expert curse of when you're seeing the expert because people want to call us, oh, you're an expert on that. And I was like, well, I know some stuff, but I'm always learning.
Yes.
Like with Dr. Lisa Barrett, just I'm always trying to see what is out there. And, you know, science disproves what was true 20 years ago. It's always evolving and things are, because we're getting more technology to find out what's going on. And so with us currently still in the pandemic, the recording of this is in 2022. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
We are really coming to grips with creativity in this nation and in the world, you know, with Canada as well. Mm-hmm. Where do you see our world going with our relationship with being truly creative from the grave, from the cradle to the grave, of how do we really start to create platforms and environments where we're not just talk, we actually are allowing people to live out their creative truth?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a big elephant to eat. I think one of the things, and Dr. George Land talks about, and Sir Ken Robinson, who unfortunately passed away, talked about this idea of killing the creativity in schools. And I think cut our teachers some slack, like it's a tough gig. But I wonder if we can incorporate some of this idea more about the ambiguity. So instead of having like an A, B, or C, like what about an M for maybe? Like teaching more, there's not necessarily a right and wrong at a young age, and being comfortable in that ambiguity. So I think that can go through into the workplace, into university, into studies, that sometimes there's a right and wrong answer, but sometimes there isn't. And how can we handle that and be more okay with that? Because I think that would help lessen some of the pressure around judgment. Is this, and I feel this, like as someone who's gone through like higher education, it's like, is this right? I'll often be in a session and someone will give instructions and I'm not completely clear. And I'm like, but I want to, what am I supposed to do? What is right here? And I think we need to get away from this idea in some cases of there being a right and wrong. And that I think will be the thing that can help open up people's creativity if they don't feel like they're going to be judged or penalized for being themselves really and saying things that are respectful, of course, but might not toe the party line, so to speak.
Yes, that's so true. I was teaching at my K-5 and a colleague came to me and said, yeah, I gave an assignment to my students to create any character that they wanted in the book using any material that they wanted in the book. Mm-hmm. And we both talked about the metaphorical connection. So, you know, if you're using beans, why are you using beans? What's the metaphor of the bean or the rice or the foil? Mm-hmm. And the kids almost freaked out. They're like, well, what do you want us to use? Okay, well, how big should it be? Well, how much should it weigh? He's like, but she was like, no, this is your creative control. You just really think about it. But what about this? And when she was telling me this story, it dawned on me, wow, we have trained our children to only follow directions, right? And the author of Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill, he said, two awful things is when you don't know how to follow directions at all and you only follow directions. You have to be mindful of those two extremes. And that was huge. And so she finally got it into them that this is what you're doing. So go home and do it. And it's a family project. I love that she involved the family to kind of think creatively as well. And what they came back with was mind-blowing. Once they finally released the limitations and the fear of judgment, a fear of getting it wrong. That's what it is. It's the fear of getting it wrong because we've conditioned them to be penalized and to feel shame with the red pen, right? Here's what you did wrong. I'm not celebrating rating your progress. Yeah. Here's what you did wrong. And so there are people in the school, the schools are hopefully becoming more mindful of what we're subconsciously giving our kids. So thank you so much for bringing that up.
I'm so curious with that. Like, I wonder if a lot of that questioning came from the parents that were like, what are you supposed to do? Right? Like, I would love to have been a fly on the wall in the homes of those kids when they were supposed to do it as a family project and how that influenced the parents. I mean, of course, I'm fascinated with the kids, but I'm even more curious about the spectrum of how the parents responded to that activity.
Yes, because we've conditioned them as well. Right? Yeah. So there's a lot of unlearned learning. I do have this quote that unlearning is an important step in the creative process because especially now, we have to really think of these new ideas. So you have an amazing book coming out. I'm so excited to talk about it, to share about it. What is it called? And what are the gems?
Well, thank you. And I'm excited about it. It's my own creative adventure into facing uncertainty and failure and judgment. I called it The Reluctant Creative. And the subtitle is 5 Effortless Habits You Can Use to Expand Your Comfort Zone. And it's based around this acronym I use, the DANCE, the Daydream Ambiguity. And to your point earlier about that book you mentioned, I love me a good scientific, juicy read. But I read so many boring creativity books, Janine. I was like, how can this be so boring? So my goal was to write a creativity book that was fun to read, that was funny. I incorporated many of my experiences as a veterinarian and some stand-up comedy experience in there to try to help people think differently about the habits they do every day. And that we are all creative. Creativity is like poop. We're full of it. So if you think you're not creative, I love that you typed that out. I mean, the ironic thing is if you think you're too left-brained or too scientific to be creative, science actually proves you wrong. You are creative. It's just there are conditions you can create to make your creativity more forefront in your world. Sometimes I talk about like creativity is like breathing. So hopefully you already have that figured out if you're watching this, you know, listening to this podcast, but you could learn techniques like box breathing or pranayama to make your breathing more effective. And I feel like creativity is the same. So what I talk about in my book is some easy habits to use every day to help your own creativity shine. And it's certainly not comprehensive. It's a start. And then from there, you could start layering on, you know, the more didactic and the more getting into the more functional systems like creative problem solving systems and things like that. But if we want more innovation and more creativity and more change in the world, we individually have to own our own creativity, which looks different to each person, in my opinion.
I fully agree. And with that, with this, I love this, the story aspect. And I put stories in my book as well that you'll see. And I think the brain just hooks on to that. And for me, I have the story to introduce it. And then the story supports the point as well. And makes the point mm-hmm. kind of come alive. And people say like, Janine, I can hear your voice when I'm reading your book.
I love it. Well, I recently reread The Alchemist, and that book is good for that as well, because it's actually a story, but the story has a message, right? And we don't necessarily, I agree with you. And that's what they've shown is that storytelling really helps us follow the idea. So I can't wait to read your book and read your stories in there.
Oh, yes, yes. Awesome. So we are excited about your book, and I hope that everyone goes to the website, The Reluctant Creative, and check it out. You just heard her speak. She is a wealth of wisdom, a well of wisdom, and a well of research, which I love. I might be emailing you for some of this research. If you have any research to send me, even if it's at 2 a.m. in the morning, say, hey, I think Janine would like this. Send it my way. I can share with you what I have if you want to read anything.
Yes.
And yes, so we are the diamonds. You know, I'm all about metaphorical thinking and the importance of that. And our company is the diamond. What final gem would you like to leave with our audience?
Final gem I would like to leave with the audience. I want to say the poop one, but I feel like I'm repeating myself. But I think the gem is the writing is on the wall. 93% of companies say they want innovation. 18% of employees feel like they can take the risks at work to be creative. That, my friends, is low-hanging fruit.
Yes. And that's really where our work comes in. I love it. And that's really where intercultural creativity comes in too, because people have to feel like they can belong to the group and yet still have ideas that may not be in line with status quo and still feel safe, psychologically safe to share these ideas. And that's why your work is so critical for businesses around the world. And you do speak around the world, and your book hopefully will be going around the world. And I'm assuming you train as well. So if people wanted to find more out about your work and you and what you do, what services you offer, what are they and where can they go?
Yeah, thank you, Janine. I'm so glad we found each other. First of all, I'd like to say thank you to the interwebs and social media, because I've met so many people like you who have really inspired me in my work. But yes, I do speaking and workshops. I call them creative refreshers for teams who are just feeling a little stuck that want you know, something that's kind of for team building, that's fun, but still has like a directed goal. And I do those virtually and in person. And I did make the bestseller list already for my book. It's like, it was number one hot new release in three categories.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So very excited about that. If you want to learn more about me and my speaking, my website is just carolinebrookfield.com. And that has some of my topics in there, has some videos. And then I also have a YouTube channel where I have a number of dares. If you're like, I don't know how to start my creativity, I have a series called I Dare You. And it's a video, short video, where I do something a little silly and I encourage you to do something silly to engage your creativity. And you can find that through my website or send me a message or send me a carrier pigeon. We'll figure it out.
That's what I say too. Just trap a note to the bird, send it my way. Awesome.
Yes. Actually, there's one thing I wanted to mention about my book when you said about the data and sending you. So I have like a massive Google folder. We can share those nerdy folders together. But one of the things that I love to say about my book is it's a literary mullet. It's fun in the front and data in the back.
I love that. And when I see a mullet, I'll think of you. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for spending your time. We say time is one of the most valuable resources. So the fact that you spent about 45 minutes with us, we really appreciate it. We hope people just feel inspired just to take one step in the right direction to enhance their intercultural creativity. You can do this on your own, but then take that step to do it with others and maybe even others that aren't like you and that have different lived experiences, that you can share these experiences with them and grow together. This is the Create and Grow podcast. We will see you next time. Don't forget, be creative, be you, and be interculturally competent so we can be our best together. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye, Janine. It was such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us at the Create and Grow podcast. We hope that you obtained some amazing gems and are able to see how you are creative and how we are more creative when we work well together. If you wish to learn more about our organizational training programs and professional development for companies, organizations, schools, and districts, visit cafestrategies.com. That's C-A-F-F-E strategies.com, where we have amazing keynote speakers and certified facilitators on board to help your organization learn how to build a climate of inclusion and innovation. We have groundbreaking book titles in our online bookstore that lay out the seven gems of intercultural creativity, as well as our children's books that inspire the innate creative ability of our little ones. We thank you again for joining us and remind you to shine bright like a diamond. See you next time.